All right. Couple of quick acknowledgments. So how about Wayne Baumgarten making his debut on the platform here? If you don't know Wayne, that accent is New Zealand, with a lot of years in America. Also, this past week, I taught a credit course at Unity Church of the Hills. Unity has this elaborate system of credit classes for lay people. And they were doing an intensive, so I taught 2 hours a day, 5 days in a row, and drove back and forth. But I love to do it. And one of the things that happened while we were there was that our own Maggie Wagner finished all the prerequisites she needs to apply for ministerial school. So have you got that application done? Okay, we're watching. Can't back out now. Okay. Jezebel. We love to hate her, even if we don't know why. Every scarlet woman is known as a Jezebel. It's become a generic term. There's a famous movie, Jezebel, with Betty Davis, which is not the Bible story. It's just about a self-centered, heartless woman. There are songs of every variety. I went and looked on iTunes, just the title Jezebel. Everyone from Frankie Lane to Edith Piaf. Also, 10,000 Maniacs, Joan Jett, Ricky Martin, Sade, Boys to Men. There are R&B versions, there are country versions, but my favorites were Acid Bath and Danger Muffin. All singing songs about bad women named Jezebel. And once again, a shady lady in the Bible has gone down in history as something she's not. Temptress, seductress. Actually, there's no sex in the story of Jezebel. As far as I know, she was a faithful wife and devoted mother. She was, however, a mean queen. She had people killed. But her real sin, like Delilah's, was being a foreign woman in a history written by the very insular Hebrews. Jezebel was a Phoenician. Her parents were high priests in the worship of Baal, B-A-A-L, the pagan god who ruled all the waters of the earth, the rain and the rivers. His consort was Asherah, who personified the fertility of all females, human and animal. And a lot of people at this time in Israel worshipped Baal and Asherah kind of along with Yahweh. But of course, the righteous Hebrews believed there was only one God, the right God, the one true God. And Jezebel's husband, King Ahab, was considered even worse than she was because he was an Israelite, but he accommodated the pagan worship of Baal, perhaps under the influence of his evil wife, Jezebel. Perhaps just to keep harmony among the people and their many gods. I'll confess I had trouble finding meaning for us in this story, and I finally realized why. It's essentially a cartoon, a violent cartoon. But Jezebel and Ahab are portrayed as all bad, they're wicked, they're irredeemable. The prophet Elijah is all good. There was more nuance in the stories we've heard up until now in this series about shady ladies. I mean, last week with David and Bathsheba, David was and still is remembered as a great king and a great man with flaws. Delilah could be seen as a patriot, helping the Philistines against their enemy Samson. Hagar was more immature than wicked, but her son Ishmael became the father of the Arab nation. The story of Jezebel and Ahab illustrates the most basic lesson of the Hebrew Bible, which we call the Old Testament, and it is this: obey God and you're blessed. Disobey God and you're cursed. All the stories are about that. Jezebel and Ahab broke 7 of the 10 commandments by my count. Maybe just 6. I'm assuming they didn't keep the Sabbath holy. And that would make 7. But sure enough, they were cursed by God for their disobedience. And the prophet Elijah was on hand to predict it and point it out. Elijah is another early Jesus figure, His name means, "My God is Yahweh." He multiplied food like Jesus with loaves and fishes. He raised a little boy from the dead. He didn't really die. He was just taken up to heaven. And then the prophet Elisha took over. So today's story stars Ahab, Jezebel, and the prophet Elijah. This is a play in three acts. It's woven through the books of 1 and 2 Kings. And when the curtain rises, Ahab is the king of Israel in Samaria, which is the northern kingdom. This is the only geography part of the talk. But you see how there are two kingdoms here? The gold one in the south is Judah. The blue one in the north is Israel. Under David and Solomon, these two were united. But this is a couple of hundred years after David. We're in the 9th century BC now. So they had split again by now. And Israel is that northern kingdom. King Ahab was an Israelite, but he had switched allegiance to the pagan god Baal, and the Bible says that angered the Lord more than all the kings before him. He also erected a pole as a symbol of Asherah, the goddess. Jezebel, meanwhile, had prophets of the Lord, the one true Hebrew God, killed whenever she could. So there's three commandments broken right there. Ahab put other gods first. He worshiped false idols. And Jezebel, you know, thou shalt not kill. So Elijah shows up on behalf of God to declare there will be a drought. Not even dew will fall. This is a direct challenge to the pagans, since Baal is the god of rain. So everyone starts praying to their god to see whose god can make it rain. It's competitive prayer. After 3 years of drought, God sent Elijah to King Ahab and said, it's time for a showdown. So gather the 850 prophets of Baal and Asherah on Mount Carmel. And the prophets were on one side and Elijah was alone on the other. Each of them slaughtered a bull and laid it out to sacrifice on a fire. And whichever side God lit the fire would win. Well, the Baal prophets prayed, they did their rituals all day long, no fire started. Then Elijah just asked, and fire fell on his offering, and everyone knew the Lord indeed is God. Elijah then killed all the pagan prophets anyway. Killing was okay when you killed the right people. And then, just to show off, a tiny puff of cloud on the horizon turned into heavy rain and the drought was ended. Well, Ahab had been there for all of this. He went home and told Jezebel what Elijah had done. You know, he embarrassed us and then he killed everybody. Here was this prophet of the Lord and he had won. So Jezebel threatened to kill Elijah within 24 hours. And Elijah fled south to Judah, end of Act 1. There's a short vignette while they're changing the scenery. While he was in Judah, Elijah was told to go stand on a mountain because the Lord was about to pass by. First came a great wind so strong that it split mountains and broke rocks. Then there was an earthquake, and then there was a great fire. But the Lord was not in any of these. After the fire was sheer silence. And Elijah knew the presence of the Lord. It was a still, small voice. That's where the phrase comes from. Act 2. During their 20-year reign, Ahab and Jezebel built a new capital city in Samaria. Their palace was called Ivory House. It had ivory carvings, ivory furniture, ivory screens, maybe even ivory walls. The palace included a temple or a shrine to Baal and Asherah. Ahab and Jezebel also built themselves a vacation villa in a place called Jezreel. Next door to the villa, a man named Naboth owned a vineyard, and Ahab really wanted that land for a vegetable garden. Naboth wouldn't sell it. Naboth was following the tradition that if land has been in your family since the settlement of Canaan, you just don't sell it outside the family. And Ahab knew that. He was an Israelite. But he really wanted that land. He coveted that land. That's four commandments broken. Thou shalt not covet anything that is thy neighbor's. Well, Ahab was so disappointed, he just went home and went to bed. He turned his face to the wall. He refused to eat. Jezebel asked, "What's wrong, honey?" And he explained, "Naboth wouldn't sell his vineyard." She said, "Are you kidding me? You're the king. Okay, you get up and eat. I'll take care of this." This was another cultural difference. Israelite kings did not have unlimited power because they had to follow Hebrew law, God's law. Jezebel's royal parents were Phoenician. They made the law. They were the law. So she was contemptuous of Ahab. She wrote a letter to the city fathers and brazenly asked them to find two men who would swear that Naboth had cursed God and king. Commandment number 5, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. But poor Naboth went on trial. These two men lied about him. Of course he was found guilty. So he and his sons were stoned to death. The land then reverted to the state, so it belonged to Ahab. I'd call that stealing land. Commandment number 6, thou shalt not steal. So God sent Elijah back to talk to Ahab in the vineyard and remind him, disobey God and you're cursed. This was Elijah's message from God. Thus says the Lord, in the place where dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, dogs will also lick up your blood. And concerning Jezebel, the Lord said, the dogs shall eat Jezebel within the bounds of Jezreel. Anyone belonging to Ahab who dies in the city, the dogs shall eat, and anyone of his who dies in the open country, the birds of the air shall eat. And then the Bible explains to us why this is necessary. Indeed, there was no one like Ahab who sold himself to do what was evil in the sight of the Lord, urged on by his wife Jezebel. He acted most abominably in going after idols. Well, after Ahab heard this, he put on sackcloth and fasted. He seemed sorry. So God gave him a reprieve. In fact, God said he would take it out on Ahab's son instead. God vowed, in his son's days, I will bring disaster on his house. Dun, dun, dun. That's the end of Act 2. Now it's a cliffhanger. Act 3 begins peacefully. It's 3 years later. But a conflict begins, and Ahab goes into battle, and someone who did not know he was the king struck him with an arrow, and it went between the pieces of his armor. He didn't die immediately. His men took him out of the battle and propped him up in a chariot and then turned it so that he could watch the action. He slowly bled to death over the course of the day, which made a real mess in the chariot where he'd been left. They washed the chariot by the pool of Samaria, and the dogs licked up his blood, just as God said. So now that Ahab was dead, his son Ahaziah took over. You remember, God had threatened disaster for Ahab and Jezebel's son. So the first son, Ahaziah, ruled for 2 years and then died in a suspicious fall. Then the second son, Jehoram, became the king. Both sons continued to worship Baal and did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. So enter a man named Jehu. Jehu was an army general known for driving his chariot like a maniac. That is the actual translation in the New Revised Standard Version, maniac. The King James Version says, he driveth furiously. Like some of you go down that hill. Jehu, the general, wanted to be king, and in fact, a delegate from the prophet Elisha told him he would be the next king of Israel. Jehu met with the current kings of Israel and Judah right in the vineyard of Naboth, the land that had been stolen by Ahab and Jezebel. And their second son, Jehoram, said to him, "Is it peace, Jehu?" Jehu answered, "What peace can there be so long as the many whoredoms and sorceries of your mother Jezebel continue. Well, you don't talk like that about someone's mama, even if she is the original Jezebel. So her son wheeled his horse around and fled. Jehu shot him in the back with an arrow and dumped his body on the land of Naboth, the land his father had coveted. Jehu's supposed to be the good guy, remember? He's been anointed the next king of Israel by the prophet Elisha. This is a military coup. So Jehu the general takes over Israel. He has just one thing left to do. With Ahab dead and his sons out of the way, Jehu heads to Jezreel, where Jezebel is in her vacation villa. The story says when Jehu came to Jezreel, Jezebel heard of it. She painted her eyes and adorned her head. That is the only place in this story she is remotely seductive. She puts on makeup because company's coming. Some commentaries say she was getting dolled up to talk Jehu out of killing her. Others say she groomed herself like a queen to preserve her dignity in death. Or maybe it was one last in-your-face statement of religion, the ornate ritual makeup and headdress of a priestess of Baal. She came to the window where royalty came out to gaze on their subjects. Jezebel's not backing down. She's not pleading for her life. This passage contains violent content that may be disturbing to some listeners. Jehu looked up to the window and said, "Who's on my side? Who?" Two or three eunuchs looked out at him. These were guys who worked for Jezebel. Jehu said, "Throw her down." So they threw her down. Some of her blood splattered on the wall and on the horses, which trampled her. Then Jehu went in to the summer palace and ate and drank, and he said, "See to that cursed woman and bury her, for she is a king's daughter." But when they went to bury her, they found no more of her than the skull and the feet and the palms of her hands. When they came back and told him, Jehu said, "This is the word of the Lord, which he spoke by his servant Elijah. In the territory of Jezreel, the dog shall eat the flesh of Jezebel. The corpse of Jezebel shall be like dung on the field in the territory of Jezreel, so that no one can say, 'This is Jezebel.'" Final curtain. The body was unrecognizable. A word about these dogs. In Jezreel's time, for a body to be eaten by dogs would have been a terrible desecration of the dead. So this story is telling us she really got hers. They weren't ordinary dogs. These were not the border collies who herded sheep. These were hunting dogs who were bred to bring down a lion. They would be turned loose to hunt without human supervision. They were hard to control. So just imagine the nastiest snarling dogs you can in a feeding frenzy on the body of this queen. But Jehu shrugs and says, "Yeah, this is what God said would happen." And that's the moral of the story. Disobey God and you're cursed. Flaunt your pagan religion in God's face and your whole family is murdered with dogs lapping up the blood and eating the corpse. Okay. So what are we to make of this story for us? It's entertaining in a gruesome way, but Unity does not teach that God punishes us or rewards us. Instead, we say the universe operates according to spiritual laws, and our lives just work better when we use the laws instead of resist them. So I didn't read this in any commentary, but personally, I believe it's no accident the story is told so that Jezebel and Ahab flagrantly break commandments. And that might be our lesson from this story. How do the Ten Commandments apply to us now? Most of us probably don't kill and steal. But you know, Unity interprets the Bible beyond the literal meaning of what's on the page. We call it Bible metaphysics. And metaphysically, every action that's forbidden by the Ten Commandments represents not just what we do, but our thinking, some part of our consciousness. This is also how Jesus explained the Ten Commandments. So let's look quickly at these ten laws. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Ahab and Jezebel were worshiping Baal, the pagan god. We might say it's easy to have no other gods, but really, where do we put our faith? In God or in fear? Or in mass consciousness? What do we really worship? Success, power, beauty, military might? I have been known to worship at the altar of other people's opinions. So who knew people-pleasing was breaking a commandment? Thou shalt not make any graven image. We don't worship golden calves. But how much effort have we sometimes put into getting a particular house or a prestigious job or social status? Sometimes we worship things or circumstances. No other gods and no graven images both say what Jesus said later, seek first the kingdom of God. Put your spiritual life before everything else, and it all falls into place. The third commandment is, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. The name of God is I Am. We take it in vain every time we attach our I Am, the divine in us, to something that is not the fullness of the divine. I am sick. I am tired. I am worthless. I'm a failure. We're taking God's name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Sabbath doesn't have to have anything to do with church. What's important is to seek out spiritual sustenance. How often do we let our minds slow down so we can hear the still, small voice? Honor your father and mother. You could say Jezebel honored her parents by continuing to worship Baal. Ahab didn't. He allowed pagan worship in Israel. But honoring your parents isn't doing everything the way they did it. It's living up to your divine potential. It's growing into the best you can be. Then, too, think of yourself as the parent. You are the parent of the divine consciousness growing in you. You're the parent of your future self. We could talk about this one a long time. Thou shalt not kill. Maybe you haven't killed someone physically. Have you ever shot down someone's dreams? Ever crushed their hopes or plans? Taken the life out of their ideas? Thou shalt not commit adultery. In marriage, we make a commitment to be physically and emotionally faithful to someone else, to make them our primary human relationship. But what about that primary relationship with ourselves? What vows to yourself have you broken? I mean, you might promise to care for yourself physically and then have an affair with the sofa and the television. You might promise to pursue spiritual life in more depth, but then dally with the distractions of the world. Those are forms of adultery, cheating yourself. To adulterate means to make something impure, to ruin something good. So it's anything less than the divine in you. Thou shalt not steal. Maybe you don't take towels from a hotel. But did you ever steal an idea, take credit for it? Some people steal energy from others. We call them energy vampires. And how might you steal from yourself? We steal from our own potential when we numb out with distractions or addictions. We steal from ourselves being too busy. We can steal from our divine identity when we attach our I am to I can't and discourage ourselves from being called higher. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Did you ever lie or gossip about someone else? And we bear false witness against ourselves whenever we claim to be less than divine. Again, watch the words attached to I am. I am unworthy in any way is false witness. And finally, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, wife, maidservant, manservant, ox, ass, or anything that is thy neighbor's. Wife is just part of the property. To covet means to have a strong desire for something that belongs to someone else. Coveting, regardless of what you covet or why, is a consciousness of lack. It's focusing on what you don't have. It's also forgetting that each of us has an individual path. You're on yours, other people are on theirs. If we really, really want something that they have, we can create it for ourselves without taking it from them. The universe is abundant and unlimited. There's enough for everyone. This is a really quick hit on the Ten Commandments. The real challenge for us is to do not just what we think is right, but to be all we're called to be, even when we're not under threat of being tossed out a window and eaten by dogs. It's not about obedience. We don't have to fear the wrath of God. Our challenge is actually greater than that. We have to make every choice from our divine identity, remembering that we are one with all that is. Spiritual laws are not something to fear, but to use. Learning how to use them is a lifelong journey. So we're grateful, even for the cartoon stories that guide us on our way. So let's take these thoughts into meditation with Kit.
Into that deep space in your heart. Allow your shoulders to drop, to relax. Continue to just move into a space where you're just free of judgment. Let your observer self simply notice. Put your attention on your fingertips. Notice your feet. Notice your heartbeat. To mind one of the commandments, one that stuck out for you a little bit more than the others. Just bring it to your awareness without judgment. Judgment comes up around it, just simply ask it. What do you have to teach me? still small voice will gently give you an image or a word or a feeling. And simply notice it. This may have a feeling that comes up more than once, more than often. This is kind of the narrative that your heart knows you would like to change or think differently about it. The Jezebel thought. So in this moment, you can look at that thought. And simply take a breath and say, stop. This is not the truth of who I am. And then the I am, the affirmation, is I am a divine being. I am beautiful, loving, unique expression of the divine. I am whole. I am healthy. I am wealthy. I am wise. I am powerful beyond measure. I am lovable. I am capable. Beautiful, powerful. And so that any time a Jezebel thought comes up, you have the power, you have the tools to say, stop. I am remembering who I am. I am God expressing as me, life through me, life divine through me. So breathe in deeply. And one more deep breath in, fully cleansing as you bring yourself back to this space.